You cannot ask the police, or you cannot ask me to sit down in partnership with somebody who is not going to be reasonable, is not going to be fair.
I'd like them to reconsider, because the collaborative is too big not to have the FOP at the table, and too important to the community.
The FOP pulls out of the collaborative agreement review. Now will they reconsider? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. That was FOP President Dan Hills and attorney Al Gerhardstein. Joining us to discuss this and other top stories are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Chris Wederick, and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. And Sharon, Chris, and Jay, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Hi there.
Yeah.
And you can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Jay, the Cincinnati FOP votes on two things at their meeting this week. They decide not to be part of the refresh and review, and they also have a no-confidence vote that they had for Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters. So let's start with the decision not to be part of the review of the collaborative agreement. What was the reason for that?
They are unhappy about some of the comments made by some of the folks who would be involved with the refresh of the collaborative, mainly attorney Al Gerhardstein and Iris Rowley, who is part of, I guess they still exist, the Black United Front.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Gerhardstein had filed a complaint with the police department and the Citizens Complaint Authority concerning the testimony of Police Sergeant Shannon Hine during the second trial of Ray Tensing. And I believe Ms. Rowley was rather critical of Sergeant Hine and the decision not to have a third trial for Ray Tensing and some comments. And so basically the FOP said, we don't like those comments and we're just not going to participate in the process.
You know, honestly, it was really interesting because, I mean, the FOP president, Dan Hills, hadn't said much during the Ray Tensing trial, and he didn't really need to. Ray Tensing's not a Cincinnati police officer. Mm-hmm. So we didn't hear from him. I'm sure everybody like me probably called him up and is like, do you want to comment? And he really didn't through the whole 2 years of everything we went through. But when Shannon Hine testified, and I was following along that day and not actually in the courtroom, I mean, everybody knew that that was a turning point. She was asked under oath, answered, you know, that she generally thought that the shooting was justified. And people walked out of there stunned that day. That was a bombshell in this trial. And, you know, the prosecutor said they were surprised. The police department said that they should not have been. Sergeant Hine told everyone all along how she felt. And it kind of came down to a he said, she said. And Sergeant Hine was eventually cleared by the police department of having told everything. And Mr. Gerhardstein, who represents Sam DeBose's family, was very upset, and he did file a complaint against her. And that has spiraled into what's going on with the collaborative refresh.
And that complaint with the Citizen Complaint Authority, that's still in play, right?
It is. But honestly, I mean, even Al Gerhardstein himself has said, you know, this report that clears Sergeant Hine, it's basically going to make the CCA complaint go away.
So now we have FOP President Dan Hill saying, now, wait a minute, maybe we're going to back up. We'll vote on this a second time. What's going on there?
The vote that happened, they have a regular FOP meeting every month. Not all the members come unless there's something controversial going on. And keep in mind, of course, a lot of them are working. You have retired officers there. And, you know, this came up and when somebody called from the floor to take votes. This was neither one of these things were Dan Hill's idea. And he has to entertain them. And they had the votes to go forward and they took the votes. But in something this important, a lot of the members have said everybody really wants to have a chance to weigh in. There's specific rules for voting to make sure all of the membership has a say. And so they agreed to take a second vote next month.
And they only had, about 10% of the membership when they took this first vote is what I've heard.
It was about 100. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, I've heard like various things. But there's 1,000 active members and 1,700 retired members.
That's what gets me right there. I don't know how many of the retired members were voting, but on such a consequential thing for the city, this collaborative refresh, I just wonder how you can have retired police officers who may live, you know, I mean, they're not required to live in the city anyway, but, you know, may not have really any, you know, participation in the city whatsoever, kind of dictating this outcome. So that just seems to me to be a huge mistake and kind of what a what a backstabbing of the mayor, who, you know, has a close relationship with the police union and also has made this collaborative refresh a huge plank in his reelection campaign.
And we'll probably never know, but I'd like to know if that was some of the behind-the-scenes tap dancing that is leading to this second vote.
Right.
Because this refresh was Mayor Cranley's idea. He talked about it last fall during his State of the City speech. He rolled it out. I believe the press conference was June 2nd when they announced that they were going to do this. Dan Hills was at the press conference. The FOP was involved with the collaborative process from the beginning back in 2002. So it had to be, there's some shuffling there someplace.
And I will say, even from the get-go, Dan Hills was there and he agreed to participate in this. And that was a key point that everyone, same people back at the table. But he didn't say, yay, this is great. He said, we'll see what happens. Of course I want to be at the table. Anything that comes out of this collaborative refresh, and I do expect there are some things to come out, even if it's just like, perhaps we're not adhering to all the things of the collaborative as we had been at the beginning, it's going to be up to the police department to implement. And they're going to be told in this agreement what they need to be doing. And I think they feel like they are doing all of the things. They are adhering to it, and they have made a lot of inroads with the Black community. And I don't know if they like how things are going down this path.
And we have to remember, too, that, I mean, this has been a rocky relationship from the start. Once even the collaborative was agreed to in 2002, I believe the Black United Front asked to be released from it, and I think that was granted. And then the FOP also said, well, if they get out, we want to get out, too. And I believe the judge at the time, Judge DeLotte, wouldn't allow that. So, I mean, this is not the first time. I mean, it's been contentious since it was first negotiated back in 2002.
And, Jay, on the timeline, 2008, that was actually the last year there was oversight on this, right?
That was the last year for federal oversight from the federally appointed monitor.
And just since 2008, they've just kept following it. Even though there's no,
I think the jury is still out on that. I mean, and that's why they even admitted that they need a refresh because, you know, a lot of things have changed. Some things weren't funded the way they were supposed to be funded. There have been a lot. I mean, through the entire time that the press, and stop me if I'm wrong on this, but the entire time it was under court monitor, it was a single police chief. And since that time, there's been at least three full-time chiefs that are new or different, and then a couple of interim chiefs in there too. So there have been a lot of leadership changes in the police department after the monitoring ended.
But a lot of it really does come down to money, because I certainly don't think any of the chiefs we've had, certainly like Jeffrey Blackwell, right? He talked about the collaborative every time you saw him. I don't think they don't want to follow it, but these things take money. I mean, like we saw a contract to like kind of keep tabs on traffic stops. That was a very big deal. Well, during the recession, all of these things got cut back, and they just $300,000 for a contract to, you know, hire a company to do that. Bye. X that out. And so that's, we went down this path, and then those things didn't really get put back in. And when, you know, Mayor Cranley came into office, we hadn't had a police recruit class in 6 years. So now we're down staffing, and he put a lot of emphasis on that. And nobody was really talking about, oh, the collaborative's been really, you know, defunded over all of this time, too, and it's going to need its money put back.
And unfortunately, the collaborative probably fell agreement to try to keep the police staffing number up, because as the city was going through budget deficits, they didn't want to cut street strength, so you can't cut salaries. Well, the salaries is a huge part of the police department budget, and unfortunately, probably some of these collaborative items they saw, for lack of a better term, as low-hanging fruit that could be cut and not affect street strength.
You know, the whole thing kind of, you know, our reputation nationally is, you know, we're the police department that, you know, we have our situation under control and we're a model for the country. And this whole thing from Hines' testimony to the FOP blow up over the collaborative and over what Rowley and Gerhard Stein said, it kind of messes that up, that reputation up a little bit. And, you know, if they can't kind of put Humpty Dumpty back together here as a result of all this stuff that's gone on, you know, I think that's, and I think there's already kind of perception among some people in town that, you know, the stuff that we talk about how we're a national model and stuff, well, there's still problems in this department, and this kind of fleshes that out a little bit, the events of the last couple of weeks.
I will say, though, that we had peaceful marches after both of the mistrials in the Tenzing case, and so lessons have been learned, and certainly applied because those were peaceful marches. They some of them went into over the Rhine. There were no problems. There were no arrests, and certainly that was an outcome that people wanted to have after everything we went through in 2001. And that's how things went down.
Sharon, how much did this decision for a revote? How much did it have to do with pressure from the African American Police Officers Association, the Sentinels?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure.
They complained pretty much about this, didn't they?
They did complain, but I'm like Sherry. I don't know. I'm not sure how much of a role that played.
Yeah. So when will the second vote be? Do we know that
yet? We don't even know that yet. Tana Weingartner checked with Dan Hills this morning, and I believe he said nothing has been scheduled, and it could be the subject of their regular monthly meeting, which will be sometime in August. I believe it was around the third Monday or something like that in August.
But again, they could still vote, even if it's full membership. They could still vote and get the same results that they don't want to participate in this.
And I haven't heard anything different. Like with talking to people, I wrote a profile on Dan Hills all week and talked to various officers, and I haven't heard anyone say, no, that was a bad decision.
Now, they also voted no confidence on Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieter. So what was that over, Jay? Same
issue? Same issue. They were upset with essentially, I don't know that President Hills felt this way, because when I asked him about that, I won't say hedge, but he said that he was going to have a conversation with Joe and talk things out. And I think the vote on that was actually closer than it was on the refresh.
Definitely closer. And there was a lot of people abstained. So I think it was a very small number of people who voted. I mean, it was shocking that somebody even brought that up. After everything that everyone's been through with Mike Allen and Joe Dieters all these years, they have enjoyed support, but nothing's totally smooth sailing. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
And they've had a pretty good relationship in the past. I mean, is this going to have much of an impact anyway on the relationship between Dieters and the Cincinnati Police Department?
I think Prosecutor Dieters issued a statement after saying he was going to continue to do his job. And I think it's something that happened. But I would think the consequences of not being involved in the refresh are greater than the no confidence vote against the prosecutor.
Although there could be electoral consequences down the road. It's a long rumor that Joe is not going to run again. It'd be interesting to see if he does or not. You know, there are other cities in the country that have had this kind of strife between their department and their community, and they have elected prosecutors who are a little bit more, you know, less confrontational, I think, than Dieter's. So it'll be interesting to see the pushback either way from the kind of the back the blue types versus the Black Lives Matter types.
Sharon?
So I do think that Prosecutor Dieter's was in a no-win situation. Like, I don't know, like, he actually did bring the toughest charges, and there was a lot of praise from certain segments of the community when that happened. Criticism, yes, about whether it really was that and whether it was overcharging, but he certainly did do it, and we've seen in many cases across the country where that wasn't the case. So here he did this. I mean, there was a very serious effort. He did the case himself. He's never lost a case that he's personally tried. So, I mean, there was some belief at the beginning that this was something that they would have liked the result of.
And to the end, he's, you know, stoked by what he did and said that he wouldn't
He knew it wasn't going to make him popular.
Right.
And he said he wouldn't change a thing about the way he handled it. We will continue our conversation. You can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. And joining us to discuss the top local stories of the week are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. And you can join us, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jay, there's been this long-running argument between Cincinnati and Hamilton County.
No.
About who controls the sewer system.
Get out.
What is it, 50 years they've been arguing over this?
Well, I don't know that they've argued for the full
15.
I was going to say 49.
Somebody cared until then.
49 and a half.
Now, do I have this right? Because this is where I get confused, and I can understand why they get confused, too. The city operates the sewer system.
That's correct.
The county owns the sewer system.
Well, owns no, the no. legal entity. Okay. Owns the legal entity.
There's the problem.
That is
there's
the only
the
thing that people
but I,
can
and
see.
And I have to, before we get into this, I have to get out a pun because I love puns. We're going to flush this out.
It's a messy topic. But yeah, we'll
no, I mean, and part of that has been the ongoing feud between Hamilton County has insisted all along that they own the sewer district, which they actually, as Chris said, they own the legal entity known as Metropolitan Sewer District.
And they have a judge's ruling from June of 2014 that says they do. Own the yeah. system.
But the city will argue that the 1968 agreement that set up MSD, they still maintain ownership of all the assets that they brought to the agreement in 1968, which includes sewer pipes and treatment plants that they owned at the time. So that, but that, and Sherry's right, there was an agreement and last year that said that the county was the owner of the sewer district and the city was the county's agent to operate the sewer district. And that's kind of why we're going to, what we're going to talk about, why they're trying to come, besides the fact that the 68 agreement expires May 1st of next year, that court ruling, I get the suspicion, kind of pushed toward this deal that they're trying to get
through. And with all respect to the court ruling, it was the U.S. magistrate judge. It was not what I would consider a full-fledged, lifetime-appointed federal judge who made that call. So,
but the
that's why the city believes it has some legal room there.
But it is.
But the county likes that decision. They're fine with that.
Yeah. Let me take us back. Honestly, not that far, because this agreement worked for years and years and years, and then the sewer system was put under a federal consent decree to clean up, and it's super expensive. Rates are skyrocketing. So in 2010, Chris Monzel, I'm almost positive that was the year, Chris Monzel was elected, and he was like, I can't raise rates by 10% every year. We cannot sustain this.
Yeah, I think rates are up something like 128% since 2004.
And he started
is the figure I saw.
Taking a very hard look at things, and he had some like support, and and they were like, we're going to hire a monitor. They hire a monitor to see what can we rein in costs. And that is when the fighting started, because the city's like, we need to do these projects just like they always had been. These are the right way to do them, and they're expensive. And the county's like, no, they can be cheaper, and we're going to cut corners. And that is when the fighting started. It was back and forth, memos, right? They would say things from the floor. It was like, I mean, I had to have written at least 20 stories about that type of fighting.
And it, clearly, I mean, if you were to associate one word with MSD, it would be fight. And that's what they're hoping, that this deal that they've worked out will eliminate the fighting, although it seems to be creating just as much fighting among the people who are going to have to approve it.
Okay. Now that you brought it up, you have to explain it. What is this deal that they've
come
up with?
Essentially, it comes down to ultimate control will transfer to the county, with the exception that there will be a 5-person board that would be appointed. The county would appoint 3 members of this board. The city would appoint 2. And they would have to have a super majority vote for major decisions such as hiring and firing the executive.
So they'd have to get 4 people out of 5 to pass anything.
Right.
Okay.
So to hire and fire the sewer director. If there were any environmental issues, such as building a new treatment plant, that would take a supermajority vote. And if they were going to change what they accept for treatment at some facilities now, which I'm not – I think it all comes in by pipes. I don't completely understand that one, but that's one of the things. And I
suspect it has to do with trucking the waste in.
Correct.
Oh, that was such a nice way to put that. It's not how we call it, but okay. Yeah,
the poo truck.
And then I think there was also that maybe relates to maybe some pension issues that could be subject to a supermajority vote as well.
So this was super important because the city's pension system also, which went to federal mediation, is finally righted. For the most part. Every employee matters and paying into the pension system. And the city cannot afford to let all of the employees become county employees and still the pension would collapse. And so, I mean, that has been a huge concern. I mean, they had their eye on the ball about what's best for citizens. What are we going to do with the sewer system itself? But then it's like, oh, boy, the pension system, too. They had no choice but to keep that into consideration. And that is where really the sticking point is, because there was a lot of congratulations and this was rolled out to huge fanfare on Wednesday. And it is a solution, that depends on the state lawmakers making a change to the law, and which
go ahead.
We don't know yet.
That to me is a huge catch, right? I mean, once you go up to Columbus with your hand out, you know, you might not come back with a hand. I feel like that is the biggest uncertainty, because you have a deal that was made by two Democrats on the county commission and the Democratic mayor and vice mayor of the city, and you have majorly objecting the Republican minority county commissioner. And I think that the folks in Columbus are going to know that, and they're going to be looking at the deal with a raised eyebrow.
So let me make sure I've got this straight. They're talking about turning the city employees who are operating the sewer system
into county employees. Yeah.
But they would stay in the city's retirement system. They'd still be part of that pension system.
Correct. Right.
Okay. But you have to get the states okay to do that.
Yeah, because state law says that if you're a county employee, you have to participate in the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System.
And the other – go ahead.
And that – obviously they have to change. Now, there was some point many years ago when the former General Hospital transferred from city control to the university control. At that time, I think there was a change in state law that allowed those people leaving city employment to work for the university, as i.e. state employees, they could choose where they wanted to be. They could either stay in the city retirement system or they could join OPERS. The change here would be there wouldn't be the choice for OPERS. The city, they would be county employees, but they would still be under the CRS retirement,
so I think
the CRS system.
There's three precedents to do this, but they're in the past. And when there was less rocky times for pension systems, I talked to State Representative Bill Seitz about whether this is likely to happen. And he says he's like, long and arduous, no matter what. And he's like, it seems to me that the state system needs employees just as much as the city does.
See, Chris thinks this is a major, and it could be, but I guess I look at it, it could go this way. The city's goal, I think, is eventually to get out of the pension business. And they are trying to get the Cincinnati retirement system into a position where they could transfer all of the city's employees to OPERS. Probably their argument is going to be, look, you let us keep the MSD employees in our city system so we can keep building toward that goal to join OPERS. And not only at that point, then, if the state were to go along, OPERS would get not only all the MSD employees, but they would get all the city employees.
Another uncertainty is whether city council will vote to agree to this. We were told there was a majority vote, and now there's a lot of we're waiting to seize. And so there's a vote next week. And I don't know how the votes are going to come down on this.
The vote's actually off till August 9th. Yeah.
Although they did say yesterday at the council meeting when they were talking about this, they could take a straw vote at a committee meeting Monday evening. Yeah. But when it first was announced, I think it was 3-3-3, 3-4, 3-against, and 3-undecided. Mm-hmm. Based on some comments from the few members who attended yesterday's meeting at City Hall, I think Chris and I were leaning toward 3 yes, 1 maybe, still the 3 opposed, and then that leaves 2 that are undecided. But my hunch tells me at the end of the day they'll have their 5 votes.
This stuff is like Mayor John Cranley's Super Bowl. I mean, this is what he is really good at, is going and negotiating these types of agreements between counties and cities. He did it with it wasn't between the county and the city, but he did it in federal court with the pension system. He did it with the banks development. This is something that he really excels at, and I have a hard time believing he will not be able to get the votes for it, particularly from Councilmember Smitherman and Sittenfeld, both of who, I just don't see them voting against him on this.
The other thing, too,
if the county still has to approve this, though, too, right? You have two sides to this whole thing.
But they've got that. They've got their 2-1 mm-hmm. there.
Chris Monzel is the only person on the commission I've heard so far correct. Who's opposed this.
But correct. What's going to be, if they don't approve this, what are they going to do? Because they have to do something by May the 1st of 2018.
Well, or the agreement just continues.
Although I would think that that's – everybody universally has complained that it doesn't work. And even outside entities, the state auditor says it doesn't work.
It sort of works. We still flush our toilets.
It doesn't work. Let's be honest.
It costs you a lot to do that, but yes, we still flush our toilets.
It doesn't work partially because of the politics of a Republican commission and a Democratic city trying to you know, control something or trying to manage something when everybody's got an agenda. And I you know, now that that is not the case, you know, you had some reasonableness on both sides in this agreement. You know, I mean, the thing about the pension in particular, you know, Commissioner Monzel's objection to it is, well, you know, we'd pay a little bit less, you know, 2 percentage points less,
yeah,
on the pensions if we were in OPERS versus being in CRS.
I think it's a 14% contribution for OPERS. It's a 16% contribution for
right,
the city.
CRS.
Yeah.
So they're already doing that. It's not an increase one way or the other. They're already paying into CRS today. That doesn't change under this agreement. You know, the fact that he wants that to change and is not really offering a solution to the Cincinnati retirement system issue just kind of tells me, and Bill cites his comment to you as well, Sherry, you know, that they kind of have it in for the city. And I've kind of long thought that, and I don't see what benefit it does to place the third largest city in the state into such a financial calamity as blowing up the pension agreement that actually finally fixed the thing.
Because somebody, I mean, and that's going to be the thing. If this goes to court, normally they don't split the baby. Somebody's going to win. Either the city's going to get the sewer district or the county's going to get the sewer district. One would assume that it probably would be the county, and that would have devastating financial impacts on the retirement system, or the county, because the ruling could be, okay, county, you get MSD, but you're going to pay the Cincinnati retirement system X millions of dollars for all the money that you're taking out of it by taking the MSD employees.
And the county
doesn't have that kind of money.
And that goes to the liberal Democrats' objections to this as well, which seem to me to be really, you know, I've not heard anything from them that convinces me that this is a bad deal. You know, there's a lot of, you know, well,
what are some of the questions they have?
Well, one of the things is the composition of the board, right? It's a 5-member board. The county has 3. The city has 2. The objection is, well, why doesn't the city have 3 and the county has 2? Why did you agree to that? And, you know, you just look at the situation, the aforementioned court ruling that Sherry mentioned, the fact that most of our judges in the county are Republican, the fact that this is before a Republican federal judge. I'm a little bit skeptical that the city can win this in a rout because over the issue of who control, you know, over the issue of the fact that they think they own the MSD assets. I mean, their bargaining position seems weak to me, and it looks to me like the mayor got the best deal that he could.
So as we knew they were negotiating this, though, that was one of the funny points of everything. It was like, who does own the assets? And then they're like, well, we're agreeing to disagree.
And that was another objection.
For what, another 45 or 50 years we'll keep disagreeing?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And that was another objection that both Monzel and the Liberal Democrats, who don't agree normally on anything, were ticked off about was, well, you didn't settle the ownership question. And it's really clear why they don't settle the ownership question, because if the city does own it, the county could have to fork over hundreds of millions of dollars for these assets. And if the county
that they don't have.
And then if the county actually owns it, well, the city is really in a weak bargaining position then.
Well, I think there's a couple things that I think that are highlighting about this. And I keep using the term, we don't want to call it an agreement.
Right. Yet. I was just going to say it's important to stress that this is not.
And we need to talk about that before we get done with this. But I think Kevin Flynn had the good point yesterday during the council meeting. He said, look, we've come up with a deal that has bipartisan opposition, and any good compromise involves everybody not getting what they want. They have to give up something. And considering, as Chris has said, you've got Democrats and a Republican who are opposed to this, Kevin Flynn said, well, then we probably got a pretty good deal. The other thing that I think is interesting is that the mayor, the vice mayor, and 2 county commissioners were routinely going to the federal courthouse at 9:30 on Tuesday morning for, I believe, 13 months. And somehow nobody caught on. I would have thought somebody would, geez, why is the mayor and the vice mayor and the county commissioners all going to the courthouse every Tuesday at 9:30?
I guess I knew about it and I just didn't report.
And you didn't tell anyone.
It was a part of it was, you know, they were negotiating. I mean, everybody knew they were negotiating. I just don't think they knew what time and where.
So. I did hear that some of those days were really long.
Yeah.
While we mentioned this is just an agreement, I don't know if you've
heard. It's just a plan, a proposal at this point.
And Chris talks about the unknown of whether the state legislature would approve the pension change. But I wonder what happens. Obviously, there's a mayoral election in November. There could be.
I heard something about that.
There could be a new mayor in January. There could be three new council members in January.
Well, there will be three new council members.
There will be three new council members. Yeah. So you've got this proposal, this letter to say we will do this agreement and it will include these things. But what I wonder is if there's that leadership change in January, is this all moot if they won't sign off on the final agreement?
Well, the legislature stays with the judge.
I mean, they still have to write. Basically, they have a letter saying we're going to do these things, and this is what it will include. But the actual document will probably be more like the 1968 agreement that has to be written yet. Hmm. If that's not done before, there could be potential changes in leadership. One wonders, you know, does this all fall apart in January if there's a new mayor and three new council members?
Well, there's precedent for that. I mean, the mayor said that the only reason the deal really happened was because Denise Driehaus beat Dennis Dieters, almost said Joe Dieters, Dennis Dieters in the commission race last year. At that point in November of 2016, these talks were basically stalled.
Okay, but if I'm a ratepayer, there's really only a few things that I want to know about this, this idea. One, is it going to get me any relief from the skyrocketing rates that I've been seeing? Is it going to get me any relief from the sewer odors? Is it going to get me any relief from backups? I mean, those are the things that if you're somebody who's paying the sewer rates down here, that's what you're really concerned about.
I'll let you know next year.
Will you? Okay.
They say that it will save $5 million a year in legal costs, and the consultants that the county the monitor that the county currently has, and the monitoring team, which includes a bunch of contractors as well. I don't actually think you'll see that in your bill, but it's money they don't have to spend on that stuff.
But because the thing that is driving rates is the consent decree and the construction projects. And each year that takes longer to complete, construction costs go up.
There's zero chance rates will go down, only because they're scheduled to go up to pay for all these new projects. Might they not go up as much is what we'll be watching for. That does not help people. There is literally, I've covered MSD since I've been covering the county in 2010. I could be writing about odor issues. I could be writing about the fights. I could be writing about this agreement. And when I get emails from readers, they want to talk about their bills. And I don't think they're going to understand a nuance that we signed this agreement and your rates are not going up as much as they were going to go up, because they're still going up. They're still very high. And that puts a lot of pressure on homeowners who live, who pay these sewer bills.
And I think, too, the county, to me, it's like the dog who chases the car. What's the dog going to do if it catches the car? You know, the county has wanted control of MSD.
Is this be careful what you wish for, Jay?
They're going to get goes through, they're going to get control of MSD, and there's not going to be any more finger pointing, well, it's the city's fault. The city pointing at the county and saying, no, it's the county's fault. It will be the county's baby to own.
But it will, though, because if you think about our other boards, board appointees are made, you know, by the city. They're not going to walk into meetings and be like, we want to put a wastewater treatment plant in such and such neighborhood without discussing it with the officials who appointed them. So I'm not sure, when it comes down to issues that where there are arguments, that they don't float back up to the top with our leaders.
No pun intended.
I mean, that was kind of another sage, observation by Kevin Flynn, which is, why do we want control of this thing in the first place? Because we are in charge, basically. We're sharing responsibility for this $3.2 billion with a B project. It's basically four, Paul Brown stadiums that we're building when we're doing this. And, you know, why do we want to be responsible for implementing that on people?
Because the best outcome you could ever have is that the system works.
Yeah, but why does the city want to be in charge of inflicting this pain on people, which is not going to go away?
Right.
Because of, I mean, the bottom line here is the rates aren't going to go anywhere, because this is all stems from the Clean Water Act. And the city and the county have to clean up, you know, the sewer system so that we don't have sewage overflows into people's basements and the rivers and streams. And that's why we're doing this.
I think people forget that. 70-some – this number is very vague on this number – 70-some consent decrees in the country.
Right.
I do know for a fact that we have the second most expensive one, only behind St. Louis.
Right.
And I know you touched on this earlier, Jay, but refresh my memory one more time. What's next for this?
There will be a series of public meetings next week. There's a public hearing Monday evening at 6:30 at the MSD headquarters. I think people can also comment next week at the county commission meeting and the city council meeting on Wednesday. One's Wednesday morning at 11. Council meets Wednesday afternoon at 2. Originally, they were thinking about voting next week, but it sounds like those votes have been delayed until August the 9th. But I think the target they're shooting for is something by August the 15th, because there's some – the county issues the bonds, I believe, to fund these MSD projects, and I think they have a bond – either a bond sale or they had to finalize bond documents by August the 15th, and they think the position will be better if some they know what the governing structure of MSD is going forward.
And it does give the city manager time to vet everything, which he said he would like to do, and he cannot do that overnight.
Yeah, they ought to give him time. I mean, you know, people would like to see the numbers on this. And there's other considerations as well for the city in terms of they bill some expenses of other departments to MSD. You know, that can be controversial sometimes with the county. So you need to really see what the financial impact is on that as well.
And Jay, any more sewer puns?
No.
Before we break away from this topic.
I thought that, no.
You're done.
You want to break away from this topic?
Well, that's not a good connection. We will continue our conversation after this, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss the top local stories of the week are Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Jay, you had a late night last night, and that's because you were out covering a public hearing about Cincinnati Children's Hospital's plans to expand in Avondale. And tell us about that. What's the hospital planning here?
Children's has a $650 million plan to build onto their existing campus. It would include an 8-story tower. There would be a parking garage underneath that tower. And then they also have a parking garage sort of across the street from the hospital campus that they want to build onto. In order to build this tower, though, they would have to essentially it would be built on what is now Erkenbrecher Avenue. So they're asking the city to vacate that portion of Erkenbrecher, and then they kind of wind it around to tie back in. I can't remember the main street that they're tying back into. Is it Burnett?
Yeah, the whole street grid over there is being overhauled. Yeah,
but part of it they would have to take part of Erkenbrecher to make this happen, and then they also have to have a couple of zoning changes. Then there was a planned development agreement that they have for where they would expand the parking garage. So there are three things that council has to approve, and that's what the public hearing was about last night.
And $650 million, that alone says it. It's a big project.
It's a big project. It would take 5 years to do it. They say they need the space. It would add, I think it was about 120 new hospital beds. And the one thing that they keep talking about is when they have a case, the number of people involved in a case is ever increasing. So what they're trying to do is basically if they had a cardiac patient, the cardiac operating room, the intensive care unit, they would be on the same floor. So there would be continuity between the departments. So that's what they're aiming to do. Some Avondale residents are not happy about this project. They don't like the fact that Erkenbrecher is being vacated. They also would have preferred that the parking garage, the expansion of the parking garage, and perhaps even the original parking garage, would have been underground, so it wasn't this, they call it a wall of concrete that they have to look at in their neighborhood. And there were, I think, about 30-some people that testified last night. The majority of them were opposed. Children's did have some supporters, but largely those were people who were in some way affiliated with the hospital, either as employees or, you know, had some role with the hospital.
But I think for those people opposed, you can't really look at this project in a singular thing. Like, oh, we don't like this project or we like it. Avondale feels very neglected. They feel like things are being done to them, like, over and over, and they just haven't had a lot of investment from the city. And so this is years in the making and not just overnight, we don't like a hospital plan. They want a grocery store. They want their neighborhood, you know, back to the historic nature that it really used to be.
Yeah, I mean, and this is something that's going on elsewhere in the country as well. I mean, Cleveland Clinic, in a sense where we have a large major hospital system, that's kind of building what the neighborhood views as like a fortress type of situation, that where they're not really included, that it doesn't really blend into the neighborhood, that it's not welcoming feeling to them. Same things kind of happen in Cleveland with the Cleveland Clinic and the neighborhood that it is in. And so it's interesting to see those two parallel things going on there. This is also a huge political, you know, issue for council members, because Children's Hospital is obviously kind of a beloved corporate citizen in town, but they didn't probably do the type of engagement that
infuse $11 million into the community. Whether that's enough or not is a different discussion, but it's something.
The community wants more than a check, I think, is the message that they've kind of sent.
And that was the theme last night, that Children should have done a better job on outreach, selling this plan to the community. And even those, you know, who are against the expansion, no one, you know, talked about Children's doing anything but good for what they do for patients, but it's just that they thought there should have been more outreach and there should have been more community involvement. Actually, the community thought that it needed more of a seat at the table as this plan was coming together.
Well, and it's important to note the Planning Commission has already signed off on this project.
And that also creates a hurdle because, and I'm not, the details aren't clear, but on some things, if the city council is opposed to this, it'll take a supermajority, which would be 6 of 9 votes, as opposed to a simple majority, which would be 5 of 9 votes. There were 4 council members there last night. Councilmember Young was the only one who offered any comments after the meeting, at the end as the meeting was wrapping up. He didn't indicate one way or the other which way he would vote. But I do anticipate that even though it is a children's expansion, there will be at least a couple, maybe three or four no votes.
He didn't indicate which way he would go, but what did he have to say?
He just was, you know, he said that he felt the same thing, that he thought that the community should have been listened to and that they should have had a seat at the table and been more involved in the process.
You know, it's interesting, the community compared the engagement to what they received from the state and the city on the Martin Luther King interchange, which to me, you know, is kind of, it sends more traffic up their way. But they felt expansion or that addition of an interchange, that they felt that they had their say on that. And
although there's a lot of rules when you're doing a state transportation project, that they come with tons of rules. So they didn't, it's not like they wanted to possibly, it's more like they had to.
But I think that's absolutely true. But I mean, it's a good thing those rules are in place.
But if the neighborhoods committee will discuss this at a meeting on Tuesday at 1 o'clock and vote, and then it would go to full council on Wednesday for a vote if that schedule holds up.
And is that the only – are those the only votes left, Jay? Do they have to get approval from anybody else before they move forward on this?
I would assume, since it's gone through Planning Commission, if they get the zoning, there might be some permitting that has to be done. Mm-hmm. But I think those should be the regulatory approvals.
Yeah, those are the major ones.
At least from the city.
Those are the major ones, yeah.
When do they plan to have this work finished if it goes forward?
It's a 5-year project, and I'm not sure they said when they would start.
It seems like one of those things that could be ongoing for quite a while, I think.
Chris, you've got a Denison update for us.
Yes, the Denison.
Denison Hotel update.
The mostly demolished Denison Hotel on Main Street in downtown. It's the demolition has kind of it's kind of hit a speed bump. And the reason is, and I think if anybody's been downtown, they've kind of noticed that it's just kind of been sitting there in the condition that it's in for quite a few weeks, maybe even months at this point. But they had to stop the demolition recently, according to a memo that was released by the city administration, because the former Denison Hotel shares a wall with the building next door. And so if they basically take down this wall, it's going to cause the other building
hurt
to,
the building next door too.
It could hurt it. Yeah,
yeah,
it could
damage
it. Yeah, damage it or make it fall down, or, you know, all kinds of potential calamities there. So the parties apparently are in negotiation over how to deal with that. And so that's a very interesting question. It's new fuel for historic preservationists who said this building never should have been torn down, that it was a historic building that should have been reused, and that there were proposals to do that. So it has caused a little bit of a heartburn for the Joseph family, which owns the building. I did ask the Joseph spokesperson the other day, you know, whether they were in any kind of negotiation to purchase the building next door, and that question wasn't really answered, which is interesting to me. I wonder what's going on with that, and if there is something, I think we could have a renewed battle over this whole block, which is...
I was going to say, if the Joseph family were to buy this building, then wouldn't they have to go through the entire process to tear it down?
They would, because it is in the Main Street Historic District.
And it's not just because it's a historic building. It's about the integrity of the neighborhood, too, from the opponent's point of view. And because they're like, it creates a gigantic hole in that block, tearing right. down more things. It would be just a big hole. And the idea is eventually that it'll be built on, but there's no plan, and it'll be a parking lot in the meantime.
Well, they have to turn – that's – the parking lot thing has been really hammered upon. Of course, there's a giant parking lot. It's probably one of the biggest parcels downtown that has nothing on it. But they actually, under the city's code, they have to turn the Denison into a little park. And so they actually had plans drawn up for that and whatnot. So, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. And I think that the story is surprisingly not over. I thought it was. But I guess we'll keep talking about it.
And speaking of demolition, Jay, we got word this week that the bridge over Central Parkway that connects Music Hall and the Town Center garage, it's going to be demolished.
That's correct. The city manager issued a memo, it was Monday of this week, that the bridge is actually, their term was, it's in imminent danger of collapse because of some bad floor beams. And if you drive on Central Parkway, you'll notice that there are two lanes of traffic blocked off, and that is directly under the worst floor beam so that there's no falling debris on cars that would pass under the bridge.
Which I did to get here, and I didn't realize that was why. Good to know.
But
keep your eyes open.
The city is working. The city had previously worked with O'Rourke Construction on a demolition plan. They never authorized it to go forward, so they're kind of updating those numbers. And within, I would assume, days or weeks, we'll have an answer on when the bridge may come down and how much it will cost. They are going to leave the foundation.
Right. This is the superstructure they're talking about tearing down.
So it'd be like the canopy and the walkway, and the piers and the foundation would remain if they should decide to rebuild it. But
they haven't decided that yet.
No. And from every indication, I would say that there's very little chance that once that bridge comes down, it's going to go back up.
Isn't there some cabling that goes between the two
actually
buildings?
It connects our building to Music Hall, and they're working on that, of how that will be rerouted.
Okay.
But when Music Hall reopens this fall, obviously Town Center Garage is a major place for people to park to go to Music Hall.
So have they got a plan in place?
They
for
are going
with that?
To shuttle people from the garage to the front door of Music Hall, and that's probably going to be the permanent solution. It'll either be shuttles or people will just have to walk. But there was even they don't like the way if they redid the bridge, the Music Hall folks apparently don't like the way it would tie into the building, because I think the only way that you can get into the building is to go through the ballroom, and I don't think they want people going through the ballroom to get to other parts of Music Hall.
This is such a classic Cincinnati problem. Like, you know, other cities would build a nice brightly lit crosswalk that, you know, they'd put cops out there and there'd be a safe passage, and we're going to pull a bus up and move people one block, you know, away. It's
my
mysterious
joke
to me.
My joke was we could lay more streetcar tracks and just run a streetcar on a loop.
Run a little loop over there,
right?
Do
not bring the streetcar into this.
We got through the whole show, Jay, and now.
he broke it. He broke the string. Well, Sharon, Chris, and Jay, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks
for having us.
Cincinnati Inquirer investigative reporter Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Rick Andres was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney.